Hi, it's Colleen O'Brien for Sharp Vision Modern LASIK. I can't believe I waited so long to have LASIK. 2018 is your year for LASIK. Don't wait another year. For a limited time, receive $1,000 off your LASIK procedure. Go online to schedule your free consultation.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Colleen is, of course, our news editor here at Cairo Radio, but also our kindness correspondent. And we... we have a genuine kindness ambassador here today.
Oh, sure. If that's what you want to call me. I think you've given me an upgrade there. Yeah, definitely. And a new book out called The Opposite of Hate, probably apropos to today, considering the divisive nature of political rhetoric or just overall civility in America seems to be on the decline. So something like a book called The Opposite of Hate sounds like a good idea to read these days. The author, Sally Cohn, you know her from her time on cable news networks as a commentator and an analyst. And we have her in the studio with us today about her new book. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So, Sally, tell me, what was the catalyst for writing this book?
Well, in addition to the landscape and environment politically that you just described, which, by the way, you know, a lot of people ask me, do I think this is the most hateful time in U.S. history? I don't. In spite of our rhetoric and aspirations to the contrary, the United States is a country that was founded on hate. In eradicating, wiping out whole populations of Native people, a country built on slavery and enslavement, and since then, fighting tooth and nail to deny rights and basic equality to group after group after group. So hate is a part of our nation. It is part of our history. It is still inculcated in our habits and our institutions. And today, it is a big problem that we now all feel more implicated in and surrounded by because of the 360 nature of media and politics today. And because of social media, we're all more engaged in too and can participate in new ways. And it's it was a problem before. It's a problem now. It's a problem we should do something about.
So then why write about it now? Why write a book on it?
Well, you know, it's been a topic I've been interested in, honestly, since I went to go to Fox News. So I spent my career as a community organizer for 15 years, working with community groups around the country, including here in Washington State and in Seattle, trying to help them make change, work on policy change and community change and do what they were trying to do better. And when I fell into the media and then eventually went to go work as a lefty commentator at Fox News, as one does.
Is that what you call yourself?
I mean, I definitely know I'm a lefty.
Okay.
I think it's fairly self-evident at this point. You know, in a nutshell, what happened was I assumed that these folks on air, off air, people watching at home, who I believed had some very hateful views, still do, in many regards, I thought they would be completely and totalistically hateful, just like mean in every single way, hateful to me, hateful, you know, and to then go to Fox and realize that these people were not 100% in every way, shape, and form hateful, but were complicated folks where we could find things we often agreed on. Nonetheless, we could, you know, have compassionate conversations. That, maybe it shouldn't have been, but it really was disruptive to my worldview. Of the
really,
quote unquote other side.
Because you thought they had to be, because of their views, they had to be just hateful persons through and
through.
I
literally thought they would be like overtly homophobic at me as I walked out. You know, that was the sort of stereo. And then what I also realized, by the way, was, oh, I hate them. Like, I've walked in here with all these ideas and generalizations and stereotypes and, you know, written them off entirely. And that's problematic. And so I realized, like, as someone who thinks I'm against hate, who's thought I was against hate my whole life, I started to see it in myself, and that made me want to understand the phenomenon of hate, how we do it, why we do it, and how we can stop.
Well, what'd you find out?
Well, a lot of things. You're going to have to read the book. among the things I learned is that, look, it turns out most people don't wake up in the morning intending to be hateful. Most people don't think they're hateful. This, by the way, is true of even people. There's you know, I've talked to people who research, you know, current terrorists and current neo-Nazis and extreme people we would consider to be in obvious hate groups. And they do not, for the most part, see themselves as hateful. What we tend to do is see ourselves as reacting to the hate of others. So we all tend to have this sort of they started it philosophy of hate, where we're kind of give ourselves a pass or see ourselves as righteous and the others as whoever the other is, as sort of endemically, inherently hateful. And the problem with that is, I mean, there's a lot of problems with that, obviously, and especially at the extremes, the violence and institutional and policy hate that that then creates. But the other problem is, if we're always pointing the finger at someone else, we never take responsibility for our piece of the puzzle. So you never are looking at the way that you participate in extreme partisanship, or the way that you replicate unconscious racial bias, or the other forms of hate that we each have to take some responsibility for, because, you know, we can't just solve this by complaining about and pointing at everyone else.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up accountability, and sort of we're unaware sometimes of what we're participating in. And because I wanted to talk to you today about the issue that was brought up with your book from a Seattle author, Ijeoma Oluo. Some of her tweets were used in your book. When she participated in an experiment back in 2015 where she decided to engage racist individuals online with quotes from Martin Luther King. And she then got notification that was in her book. She says, fine, fair use, that's public. But she said you got the context wrong, that this wasn't her trying to express love. It was her doing a very painful, in the end, experiment. And she hasn't heard from you yet. So talk to me about what you've learned from that interaction with Ijeoma, and if you plan to reach out with her.
There's been several controversies that have come out in this regard, and the truth is hers came out in the context of one other accusation that was made. And
what accusation is that?
Oh, sorry. This. Hey, Sally. Let's add on. A woman of color named Aminatou Sow raised an issue about she believed she was misquoted in my book, and so she raised that accusation first. And the day after, Ijeoma Oluo added to her concerns about how then she felt she was juxtaposed. So it wasn't.
Right.
They can speak for themselves, obviously. But I don't want to misrepresent. Her critique is actually more profound in a way, which is not just that Ijeoma's tweets were taken out of context. She doesn't like the context in which they were represented, but also that I'd
explain who these people are, though, because I don't think most people have heard of them.
Sure. Well, we've had Ijeoma on before, so she's a Seattle author. She wrote actually the book, and so you want to talk about race, but she has been a public speaker, a community activist for many years, very outspoken online. And one of those instances online in 2015 involved her sort of in a personal experiment talking to people who were outwardly racist towards her on Twitter by responding to them using quotes from Martin Luther King Jr. And in the end, she decided it was a very painful experience because it was not easy. It was very hurtful to read those things. And she believes that Sally was using those tweets to juxtapose her with another person of color. So as an example of, we can heal racism through love. And she said that's not
right.
What it was about.
Which
so
is
she's
also,
been waiting for you to respond
well,
to that.
And to be clear, is also a misrepresentation of my work. So part of the issue here is that there are some things that are being, that are untrue. I've tried to correct the facts. I've tried to certainly correct the record.
Did she accuse you of something? What did she
I've tried to correct the record of my intentions. But, you know, listen, there's intentions are only as important as impact. And obviously, here's what's true. I had an impact in the case of both of these women whose work and whose voices I respect tremendously, where they feel like not only I misrepresented them and their intentions, but created a juxtaposition and
that maybe
pitted
them
against
each other. Yeah.
And that wasn't my intention. Again, intention isn't the same as impact. That was clearly the impact that's felt, and I'm sorry. And I...
You're in Ijeoma's backyard in Seattle. Have you reached out to her?
I can continue to apologize,
yeah.
And have continued to apologize. And my hope, my full hope and intention is that, look, I don't happen to think that bringing these issues up online is not the constructive way to have conversations. I have been open to and will continue to be open to, and there have been some private exchanges. But listen, my hope is that eventually at a private level, we can have these conversations but not in the, that
Well, your book is very public, so why not have the conversation with Ijeoma in public? I spoke to her yesterday, and you haven't reached out.
Listen, my hope continues to be, first of all, I have made public apologies. I will continue to make public apologies. My hope continues to be that when the intensity of the when the intensity of this has, look, I'm sorry. I don't want. I'm not going. You're right. I guess I don't.
I think this is all part of the conversation.
I don't even know what you guys said to each other.
I'm sorry.
What did you guys
say? What I'm trying to say.
Hang on.
Listen,
Wait a second. Listening to this, I would have no idea what you two are talking about. So what did you say to her? And
right.
What did she
say
back to you?
No. Listen, listen, first of all, again, this is complicated because, you know, A, there have been private exchanges between me and Aminatou So, some of which she's made public. And second of all, listen, I don't have an interest in having these conversations in the nature of a heated public online campaign that where there are all kinds of swirls and things happening. And to be honest, that's not who I am as a person. Mm-hmm. And I don't like being put in a position where to defend myself, I have to attack someone else. I won't do it.
Yeah.
So do I hope eventually that when the context around this has this sort of intent, you know, yes, my hope. Look,
is that you'll reach out to
her. But the other truth here,
the book is about the opposite of hate, right?
Wait.
In America right now, we're talking a lot about the racial divide, white feminists, black feminists. And so the idea that perhaps a mistake was made by a seemingly well-intentioned white feminist, that perhaps a conversation should happen, and that's what you're promoting in your book, The Opposite of Hate. So in bringing it up,
she's
a Seattle author. It's a local issue for us. Just curious if you are going to try to practice what you're preaching in your book and reach out to have that private conversation.
Listen, again, first of all, I have tried to, in this whole situation, handle it as earnestly and honestly and directly as I can to clarify the facts from my perspective. Other people have their truth and their perspective. And to take direct and accountable responsibility for my mistakes, my blind spots. It is true, as a white woman, I did not see how I was juxtaposing their work and pitting, it wasn't my intention, but as I said, intention is not the same thing as impact. I have apologized. All I can do going forward is try to learn and try to be better. And I am trying to do that work and trying to do it in a constructive way. And when people are interested, anyone who is interested in having that conversation with me in a constructive way, as opposed to in a constructive way.
Sure.
I'm there for it. And I've continued to. Look, it's brought up at every book event.
Well, it's incredible, right? Too, to talk about accountability and growth, considering you were talking about accountability and growth when you walked into Fox News. So I think this is all along the same vein of understanding our blind spots, understanding where we can improve to create love, the opposite of hate.
Listen, it is always hard to learn lessons. It's certainly hard to learn lessons in public. And I think one of the things I hope is that more of us, right? This is the only way any of us get better and grow and change. So we have to be able to challenge each other. I believe in that firmly, and have tried in my own life to practice that. It's part of why I try to be very open in general about my mistakes, my blind spots. It's not useful to just accuse others and not be open to being vulnerable and honest and critical of yourself. And I also, look, I stand for a certain set of values and principles in terms of how I engage and in terms of how others engage with me. And I look forward to having, I've tried to have this conversation, as I said, with everyone who is, you know, engaging in an honest and constructive way. And I look forward to continuing to do so, you know, in every single way in the future.
So it sounds like you're not ready to have that conversation with Ijeoma yet.
um, Listen, I appreciate the... I have tried to have to be responsive and honest and direct. And when I clearly did something that hurt two people whose work and whose voices I care about tremendously. And I'll be honest, I feel like maybe I'm still screwing it up, because everything I feel like I've tried to do to make amends and make it better has ended up being turned or twisted against me. So at the moment, right, I can tell there's a lot of feeling and hurt and pain, and I want to have a constructive conversation. I feel like I've tried to make, and I have made on, I think I've made two statements on Twitter. I don't think these are the constructive conversations to have on social media. Social media lacks nuance and,
sure.
Right? So
where else in America can we have these constructive conversations?
In living rooms and in private exchanges. You know, one of the things I've been touched by in hearing how people have been responding to the book is hearing stories of people who have, you know, they have friends or family members who they've become alienated from because of the 2016 election or the 2008 election or because of issues of identity, and have done things like said, okay, we're going to do a reading group together. We're going to do a study group together where we're once a month, we're going to get on Skype with each other and we're going to read each other's, we're going to research each other's perspectives on this hot button issue. And we're going to, and we're not going to do it in, you know, 140,
online.
Right? We're going to do it personally because we're going to start from a place of, I know you want to be helpful here. I know you want to be constructive. And we're going to start from a place of recognizing that if you're trying to get it right, you're going to make a mistake. You're going to make a mistake. So clearly here, I made a mistake. Then what? Right? How do we move? And again, you know, listen, this is an interesting thing about apologies. And I know this in my book. In my book, one of the stories is that, I mean, I've known this in general, but one of the stories is that I was a bully as a kid and I ended up seeking out the person who I, one of the people I had bullied, the person I'd bullied the most. And I apologized. It's not, I'm not entitled to be forgiven. Right? That's not how it works. And so, you know, again, the question to me is how can all of us, I hope, right, engage with each other in ways that are constructive, not destructive, and that create the space for people to become better, as opposed to, written off or when they make a mistake.
Dave, this is something you've practiced your entire career, having
what?
Fair conversations, civil conversations with individuals
who
think differently
Twitter.
Than you.
I think the whole Twitter stuff is garbage myself. Trying to have a serious conversation on Twitter is like trying to have a serious conversation in Morse code. So if you want to have a serious conversation, you first have to understand where the other person is coming from. Sometimes that involves how they were brought up or where they lived or what things have happened to them in their lives. And usually when you talk to somebody like that who, let's take the neo-Nazis, you find out many times there's been childhood trauma. They've been slapped down. They're looking for a way to create some sort of a self-respect in their lives. And they fall in with a group which seems to have a camaraderie which they didn't have in their other lives. And then it gets out of hand. But there's nothing, Twitter has accomplished nothing except draw eyes to social media for the purpose of selling products, as far as I can tell. And you must have found out in working at Fox News that there is a special expectation there of the people who work there to serve a certain audience. And they're going to act for that audience. It's a show. That many of them are just actors. I know talk show hosts who are one thing in public and a different thing in private. They actually turn out to be really normal people, and you talk to them one-on-one without that that need to cater to an audience. So, in fact, trying to have these discussions even on the radio is almost fruitless because everybody will take away from it what they want. They haven't met us. They only hear our voices. I have a feeling that 90% don't even know what you guys are talking about in this particular case. So, I mean, that's the first thing.
Well, what we're talking about at the root is accountability. And I think that's what you're talking about, too, in the divisions in America, is if we all can just own up to our own blind spots and hold ourselves accountability to our biases, perhaps we can have more constructive conversations.
Nobody wants to sit down and say, well, yes, I'm biased. Nobody wants to sit down and say, yes, well, I'm a racist. No, once you those words enter the conversation, communication's over, because now you set up a situation where somebody's got to win, somebody's got to lose.
See, I don't think that's true. Right. I actually believe that there is a possibility that I think that's the way it's been set up. Right. And that we are a product of both the history of division and racism and right. We are a product of that as people. That leaves its mark both on our institutions and systems and on us and our psyches. And we have been taught that this is a zero sum game. But, you know, I happen to believe, and one of the reasons I'm a progressive is I believe that the liberation of the most marginalized is inherently to the benefit of all of us. That it is not that some will have to suffer when we have justice and equality and freedom for all. No, that in fact, justice and equality and freedom for all means all, and that everyone benefits and gains. And that there is a way in which, in part because of the history of the political manipulation of racial resentment and hate mongering in our country in general, through the media, through politicians, et cetera, there is a way in which there has been a message, there has been an explicit effort to say that, in fact, no, when this group gets equality, you suffer. That is not true. And for instance, it blinds us to, or it stops us from looking at the reality. So, for instance, you look at the kind of attack of, you know, white people in general against affirmative action in the sense that affirmative action is hurting them. The largest beneficiaries of affirmative action, according to study after study after study in this country, are white women. Affirmative action has benefited white women. It's not, it helps. It helps everyone. So, you know, I don't think it has to be a zero sum game. I do think part of the piece and part of what I've tried to do with this book is to, you know, yes, talk to ex-neo-Nazis and ex-terrorists and learn about these lives of people who left the most extraordinary kinds of hate behind to show that it's possible for any of us, but also to take some of the sting and fear out of just acknowledging, yeah, we all have bias. I have it too. And as painful as it can be to screw up, as painful as it can be to be called on it, as painful, right? That's the only way we move forward. That's the only way we move forward.
When was there ever a time that people didn't have bias?
Never.
Okay, so what are we talking about?
Doesn't mean you got to fix it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we acknowledge it and we move on.
If it's enough to move on anymore, no. Though, and I think that's what this movement is about, is not just acknowledging our biases and moving on, but acknowledging
them. We're talking useless generalities. The problem we get to, let's take the gun issue, the debate I was recently in. So we want to treat all groups fairly. There's a certain group in America which feels that to treat them fairly means that they have a Second Amendment right to own a gun. They're not going to shoot you with it. They just feel more secure with that gun. So the question is then, are we going to understand that, or are we going to impose laws on them? And I'm talking from their point of view now, that punish them for having done nothing except wanting to own a gun.
Right, except, first of all, that goes back to the larger question of, you know, lack of nuance in our politics and debates in general right now, that it becomes about taking away all the guns or allowing all the guns, and that there is a vast, vast reality in the middle, right, including the fact that 87% of NRA members themselves support common sense gun controls that the NRA itself opposes. That also coexists alongside our biases, right, of why we have this perception that you need to be safe to have a weapon, and who, you know, people are protecting themselves from, and the fact that ammunition and gun sales went up after the election of Barack Obama, as, by the way, did implicit racial bias in this country. Listen, we are a complicated people with a complicated history, and we can't untangle these things. And I don't think it's as simple as acknowledge it and move on. It's acknowledge it, then try to learn to see it in yourself and unravel it, every single step.
And so how, give me an example of how that changes.
And right? Also fix, and also work to fix the policies, fix institutions. Look, we have schools that are more segregated right now, more racially segregated right now in our country than 20 years ago. We have a situation where 3/4 of white Americans say they don't have any non-white friends. Most Americans say they don't know any Muslims. You know, these are personal, but they're also the result of structures of how we live, of the history of redlining and racial discrimination in housing that then feeds segregation, of economic inequality that means that you don't have people going to school and living next door to people of different classes. We have to address all the levels.
That's about where people are living. So how would you mix up the neighborhoods more?
Well, that's where, again, it has to do with individual. There is a piece of individual responsibility and accountability. Seeing that as a problem and deciding to do something about it at your own level.
Which would
and,
be what?
And
I keep hearing this. Sorry. But nobody tells me what to do. So in other words, should white people feel bad if they don't intentionally move into a black neighborhood and vice versa?
I think that, you know, look, again, what I'm saying is you're asking for simple answers to complicated questions.
No, I'm asking just one answer to an individual decision.
And I think a good first step is probably looking at your neighborhood makeup and saying, hey, I don't have any neighbors who are of color other than white. Why is that? And questioning why that is, and then seeing if you can do anything about that. Is there an HOA? Is there a restrictive, you know, so I think it's.
I'm saying two things, though. I'm also saying we need to address it at the level of policy. So one of the things I look at, for instance, in the book is the example in Omaha school districts. Omaha school districts, they have several little basically fiefdom school districts that were created by white flight. That when schools were being integrated post Brown versus Board of Education in the city, white folks were like, no, we don't want to do that. And they literally created little white enclave school districts separate from the city school district. They have worked to, and the city school district has pushed to reintegrate those districts and to have a common education plan. And now that kids can go right between the different districts and not just be right. So that's there's solutions at the policy level, right? When we look at histories of housing discrimination and redlining and right. And we look at how schools are funded that, you know, you end up, if you're going to fund schools based on property values and you have a history of class and racial discrimination and property, then you're going to end up with unequal schools.
But you understand decisions were made before most of those people who are there now were born.
Yeah, so it's not your fault, but it's your responsibility to work to fix it. Okay. And then at the individual level.
It involves forcing people to do something they wouldn't normally do.
It's about, it's about fixing inequality in our country. It's about recognizing that the patterns and habits and institutions and policies we have didn't just spring on their own from whole cloth. They are the result of a endemically messed up history we have, and so we have to fix them and at the individual level start to see those patterns of injustice and say, hey, I'm not going to blindly be pulled into the, I'm going to also work at an individual level to challenge it and unravel it.
Which means that the government doesn't have to do anything. People will spontaneously get to know each other.
No, I'm saying both.
You're saying the government needs to do something.
I'm saying when you have...
But that's what busing was about. Busing was the government saying, your child will go to this school for the sake of racial harmony.
And are you
harmony.
Saying you're against that?
I'm just asking you whether it worked or not. Did it work?
I'm asking if you're against that.
Well, I'm not.
I mean, are you
but
saying
there
that-
are a lot of people who apparently had a very visceral reaction to it. You read on Common Ground, J. Anthony Lucas, the story of how liberals reacted when their policies were put in place for their kids.
Right, but that's a great point. That's an example of where white liberals are, you know, white liberals tend to point their fingers at conservative whites and say, oh, they're the problem and not-
They talk about homelessness and they live in single family homes here on Queen Anne and don't want any kind of upzone.
So what I'm saying is there should be policy solutions that implicate everyone and that we should all, instead of just pointing our fingers at everyone else and saying, oh, look at them, they're so hateful. Oh, look at them, they're such a part of the problem. Start to see our own behavior and how we are implicated and how we, each of us, all of us, perpetuate these dynamics as well and take some responsibility. So it is, I think it is both and.
Okay. Sally Cohn, thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.